Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the August-September 2024 issue of Guideposts with articles like The Marble Track. Family Time, The Marble Track. For this empty nest mom, the old fridge was part of the family, and she wasn't ready to let go, by Julie Lavender, Statesboro, Georgia. They say misfortune comes in threes. Maybe I'm over-dramatizing, but I sure was stressed out. My husband David had recently been handed a bunch of new responsibilities at work. He came home every evening tense and distracted. Then the third of our four children, the only one still living under our roof, moved out. He'd finished his master's degree and landed a good job in a city an hour away. Our two oldest had been on their own for several years. Our youngest was a senior in college. After some 25 happy years as a homeschooling mom, I was officially done with active parenting. I wasn't handling it well. I felt lonely and bereft. Parenting and homeschooling had been callings from God. Now they were gone. I couldn't even share my feelings with David. He already had enough on his plate. To top it all off, our refrigerator chose that week to break down. I discovered the problem when I reached for a soda. No cold Diet Coke. Now that was an emergency. I called a repairman and shuffled cheese, meat, milk, and condiments to the refrigerator in the garage. The repairman arrived, pulled the fridge from the wall, and shook his head. "Nothing's going to resurrect this old thing," he said. "You'll have to start over with a new one." Start over? Did he not realize this fridge was part of our family? That I didn't want to start over? That I was tired of all the changes in my life and just wanted things to stay the same? This fridge was almost as old as our college senior daughter, Jessica. It had fed our family, including teenagers and their always hungry friends, for nearly two decades. It was literally covered with memories. Magnets, vacations, postcards, baby photos, graduation photos, random phone numbers, kids' artwork, and of course, the marble track. For a few years back in the 1990s, before Jessica was born, our family had signed up to review new toys. Manufacturers sent toys the kids played with them, and then we mailed back a form with our opinions. The best of those toys was a magnetic marble track you stuck to your refrigerator and arranged in various combinations to guide a marble down the side of the fridge through rails, dips, swinging buckets, a tiny Ferris wheel, and a tornado-shaped funnel. Every kid who entered our home, no matter what the age, gravitated instantly to the marble track. It was the coolest toy of all. Our whole family loved it. Did I have to say goodbye to that too? A few days later, I stood staring at the fridge, waiting for the delivery truck to arrive with its replacement. I'd cleaned out the inside, but couldn't bring myself to strip the outside. I remembered sitting on the kitchen floor with the toddlers in my lap, arranging colored magnetic letters on the refrigerator door. I thought of all the crayon drawings, finger painting masterpieces, Sunday school worksheets, the I love you, mommy and daddy notes I'd posted there. We'd bought the fridge when we built the house in 2003. Before that, David had served 20 years as a medical entomologist for the Navy. We'd moved all over the place. This house and the fridge represented stability. With a heavy heart, I plopped a bin in front of the fridge and began clearing off the door and the sides. The last to go was the marble track. I laid it piece by piece in the bin. The empty fridge hurt almost as badly as the four empty bedrooms in the house. Taking care of my kids had given my life such meaning. "What do I do now?" I said aloud to no one. God has a sense of humor. The doorbell rang at that exact moment. A pair of lumberjack-looking men unloaded the new refrigerator, hooked up the water supply and ice maker, and peeled off protective plastic wrap. The untouched white door gleamed. The fridge hummed as it started cooling. "Give it a little time," said strongman number one. "It'll take some adjusting," strongman number two said, when I told him I didn't know how to operate the new ice maker. Did these guys know I needed help adjusting to a lot more than a new ice maker? I just finished transferring the cold items back from the garage when Jessica sauntered through the door. "Just throwing some clothes in the wash, Mom," she called without saying hello. She poked her head in the kitchen. I'll work on my paper here until my clothes finish, then I have a meeting to go to on campus later. She noticed the new fridge. Looks great, she said. When are you putting the magnets back? I've been thinking that since you guys are all moved out, we don't need them anymore, I said, trying to hide the catch in my voice. I figured no one would care. Mom, Jessica cried, you have to put the marble track back. It belongs on our refrigerator. It's older than me. Jessica was our stage-loving dancer, a communications major. She was also our most sentimental child. Really? I said. She rolled her eyes, sat down her backpack, and marched to the bin with the magnets. This marble track is part of our childhoods. How could you even think about getting rid of it? She spent the rest of the washing machine cycle retrieving the pieces of marble track and arranging them on the refrigerator. I loaded the dishwasher and tried to look casual. Soon I heard the familiar sound of marbles rolling and thunking their way down the side of the fridge. Occasionally a marble jumped the track and Jessica sprinted across the kitchen to catch it before it rolled under something. Phew, she announced. Done. I couldn't remember the old path we had set up, so I made a new path. It still works great. She grabbed her backpack and headed to her old room to finish her paper while her clothes dried. I gazed at the refrigerator, its gleaming surface no longer pristine. A new path. Yes, my life was taking a different path now. But that didn't mean the old path had been obliterated or no longer held value. In God's time, what's old is new, and what's new is old. Everything is part of an unfolding story. God would show me a new purpose when He was ready. For now, all I had to do was give thanks for what has been and what is to come. I opened the fridge and pulled out the cheese and butter. I had a feeling Jessica would be hungry when she finished that paper. Some mother-daughter grilled cheese sandwiches before her on-campus meeting sounded just right. For more on this story, see Family Room. Joy at work. An answer in the stillness. My friend didn't mean to do it, but her remark made me doubt myself all over again. By Michelle Stifler, Mesa, Arizona. I pulled into the driveway that fall Friday at the end of a long but uplifting day. I worked for a nonprofit as a mentor and coach for women in crisis. I'd spent the afternoon speaking to women in a prison reentry program. I'd really connected with them, and I was still feeling the adrenaline rush of knowing I'd made a difference. I parked the car and sat back for a moment to savor my success. Then my phone rang. It was a friend who'd encouraged me in my decision 5 years ago to reenter the workforce despite being a married mother of four. I'd mentioned to her how excited I was for today. How'd it go? She asked. It was incredible, I said, sharing some highlights. Sounds amazing. You've had such unique experiences, she said. Too bad you don't have a degree in social work. Then you'd have something to show for all your effort. I flinched, not sure how to respond. I knew my friend hadn't meant to hurt me, but it wasn't the first time someone had complimented me and invalidated me in the same breath. My friend was a teacher. Of course she valued education, and I loved learning too, but our life journeys had taken her and me down far different paths. I've got to go make dinner, I managed to get out. The kids are waiting. I hung up, but the damage was done. Maybe I'm not really qualified, I thought, an all-too-familiar refrain in my head lately. I'd grown up assuming I would follow the 4-year college path that my parents and most of my friends did, but a teenage pregnancy scuttled those plans. I'd earned an associate's degree juggling classes and single motherhood, keeping good grades while managing the inventory at a bookstore, surviving on a few hours of sleep a night. People would congratulate me on my degree, then add, "You can always go back to school later," as if education I'd already worked so hard for counted for nothing. I didn't have the desire, the time, or the finances to return to school. Still, there were moments when insecurity about not having a 4-year degree would get the better of me. Just as I was feeling good about an accomplishment, there would be someone to remind me of what I lacked. Now, this offhand comment from my friend had me falling into a swirling self-doubt again. As I cleaned up the kitchen after dinner, I sent up a quick prayer. I tended to talk to God in the moment, sharing whatever was on my mind, not necessarily expecting a reply. Lord, what do I do with this? I asked. This time I got an immediate answer. Meet me outside for prayer first thing in the morning. What an odd thing for God to request of me. But I was an early riser. Why not give it a try? Before dawn the next morning, I made coffee and carried it outside. The stars were still bright against the dark sky, and the air was cool, a welcome change from the long desert summer. I spread out a blanket by the pool, lay under the sky, and launched into prayer. I prayed the way I'd grown up praying, for a list of people and situations. I was going through my concerns for each of my children when I felt God say, "One thing at a time." I paused, allowing my breath to slow. An owl's hoot carried softly from the neighbor's siso tree. I relaxed the tension in my shoulders, my hips, my feet. My mind quieted, and I began to sense what my heart truly wanted to say. I took a deep breath. "Lord," I said, "I'm worried that I'm not qualified for the work you've called me to do." It was the first time I'd given voice to my self-doubts. I didn't say anything more. I didn't attach a request about what I needed. I didn't rush into my next thought. I just lay there and listened for God's response. I heard nothing in the stillness. I'd never been comfortable when there was a lull in a conversation. But somehow under the stars that morning, the silence felt like peace. Peace that insecurity had been stealing from me. I decided to return to early morning prayer for the next 10 days, curious to see what would happen. The next few mornings were similar. I lay under the stars and put my attention toward relaxing my body. Rather than looking past creation, I took notice. A shooting star, the wind in the palm trees, the clouds taking shape as the sky brightened. When I felt the nudge to pray, I did, releasing each thought into the stillness. There were no epiphanies, no revelations, just peace. On the sixth morning, I woke with a question on my mind that I knew I had to take to God. I went outside and stretched out on my blanket. "Lord, I trust you," I said, "and I trust that you've called me to do this work, but it's important work and I'm passionate about it," which makes me wonder, did you really mean to choose me? I could mess things up. I'm not sure I should be trusted to do work I care so much about. There it was. I had trust issues with myself, and despite how I'd started my prayer, also with God. After all, I was questioning his judgment. Over the past 25 years, I'd taken a variety of jobs. They fit my family's needs. The part-time hours meshed with my kids' school day, or the location was close to home, or the schedule was flexible. I'd enjoyed the jobs, but none had felt permanent. None had given me a sense of purpose or passion until now. Did I believe that I wasn't good enough to do work that brought me joy and fulfillment? That I was destined to mess up a job that had finally made me come alive? I wondered, gazing up at the heavens, did I really have so little faith in myself? There in the stillness, I heard God speak, "Whatever I call you to do, I will prepare you and equip you to do it. I delight in you, and my plans for you are good. Delight in them without fear. I am with you always." In that moment, I finally understood that God wasn't just promising to be with me in the future. He was already with me in the present. He'd been with me in this work all along, the work he entrusted me with. When people came to the nonprofit for help, the Lord gave me the empathy and wisdom to discover the deeper needs they brought with them. During mentoring sessions, he'd given me the right words to say at the right time. When I taught a woman in recovery, God had brought things to mind that helped me answer difficult questions. And the day at the prison, he'd enabled me to connect with women who often put up walls. I hadn't needed a particular degree to do any of these things. I only needed the divine. The moon was round and luminous. The owl that visited the neighbor's siso tree was singing to another owl echoing back. The horizon was just beginning to warm with oranges and pinks. There in the calm, I felt an overflow of gratitude that the creator of the universe saw me and loved me. He had invited me to draw close each morning because he wanted me to know him differently. He wanted me to know myself differently too, and he was willing to teach me. In the stillness of the early morning, away from distractions, I could settle into the practice of prayer. I committed to another 10 mornings, then a month. 6 months later, morning prayer outside wasn't a decision I had to make. It was a rhythm that still sustains me. This morning, I cozied into my usual spot for prayer, just as I have for the past 5 years. God doesn't always speak directly to me, but I am always listening, learning to trust him and myself. or. For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime, on demand, at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Encounters and Connections, The Son I Never Knew by Kenny Johnson, Gallatin, Tennessee. I didn't consider myself father material. 23andMe disagreed. My wife Lori and I had just settled down to watch a movie in the living room when my phone buzzed, a text message, spam probably. I reached over to silence the phone. "Hi," said the text. That was all. Weird, I thought. Was it someone I knew? I checked the message and a new screen popped up. The message must have contained a link. The screen showed an image of a tree, like a family tree. At the end of one branch was a name, Michael. Under the name were four words, "This is your son." My son? Lori and I didn't have kids. That was our decision when we got married more than two decades earlier. Lori wanted to focus on her career, and I, well, let's just say I didn't consider myself good father material. I didn't have kids from my disastrous first marriage either. A strange nervousness came over me. I excused myself and took the phone into the bathroom. I realized the family tree was on the website of ancestry and genetics company called 23andMe. Maybe a dozen years ago, Lori and I submitted DNA samples to 23andMe out of curiosity about our family backgrounds. I'd barely given it a thought since. Was there something about my past that not even I knew about? An icon on the page showed there were more messages from whoever had sent that hi text. I hesitated. Part of me was scared. Part of me was excited. I reached out and tapped the icon. When I say I wasn't good father material, I'm not exaggerating. I grew up in West Virginia in a large family without much money. Our neighbors were bikers on one side, the church on the other. We didn't go to church. I started smoking marijuana when I was 13. I was a party guy, a regular drinker and drug user by the time I was in my 20s. The people I met at parties didn't make me reconsider my rejection of church. I saw so many people smoking joints and getting drunk on Saturday night, then rolling into church the following mornings as if they were model citizens. To me, church meant hypocrisy. My sister's husband owned a pizza shop franchise in Mississippi. He gave me a job, and I spent most of the 80s rotating between pizza shops and partying. The decade was a blur of booze, weed, and one-night stands. I straightened out enough during my early 30s to get a stable job as a tool and die maker in Tennessee. That's where I met Lori. She liked to party too, but she had her act together. She worked in banking and wasn't addicted to anything like I was. She married me anyway. We settled into a kind of truce about my substance use. I drank and smoked weed every other day, but I held on my job and didn't rock the boat at home. Lori focused on work, and we stayed companionable. As I mentioned, along the way, we tried 23andMe just for fun. I thought I had let the account lapse. 4 years ago, our lives changed in a big way. Don't judge me when I tell you I used to believe some pretty crazy stuff. Like I was into the idea that ancient aliens helped humanity make major civilization advances. I'm not the only one. It's all over the internet. I ate it up. There's a church up the hill from our house. For years, I didn't pay any attention to it. One day, though, I got to wondering. The Bible is one of the most ancient texts ever written. Did it have anything about aliens? I resolved to go to that church and check things out. I bought a Bible and leafed through it. Lots of gibberish I didn't understand. That was one of those placeholder ribbons attached to the spine. I put the ribbon back and closed the Bible. Weird book. The next Sunday, I went to the church. The preacher started talking about someone named John the Baptist. I wanted the preacher to get to those really ancient guys like Moses, who might have known the aliens. "Turn your Bible to Matthew chapter 3," the preacher said. I pulled out my new Bible, and it fell open to the page with the ribbon. Matthew chapter 3. That freaked me out. Chills ran through my body. I started crying. What was happening to me? I got out of that church as fast as possible when the service ended. Back home, I paced around the garage, my man cave. That's where I kept my weed in a toolbox. "What's going on?" I said out loud. I felt a strong urge to get on my knees and pray. The preacher had said getting to know God was as simple as praying to Jesus and asking him to come into your life. I did that, not even knowing why. Immediately, I felt a huge peace descend over me. The darkness of all my years of bad behavior seemed to exit my soul. I looked around. The garage was still, silent. Everything was the same. I wasn't. I could go on about this conversion experience, but the bottom line is I was a changed man after that. I began going to church and studying my Bible. Lori joined me. She and I both became Christians. My desire to drink and smoke weed simply vanished. I know that many people, good people, struggle with substance abuse and take years to achieve stable recovery. I respect that. God had a different plan for me. He replaced my destructive habits with a desire to know and serve Him. I didn't want to do all those harmful things anymore. It was God's gift. Lori and I got involved at the church and joined a small group. The group had lots of parents, and I began to realize just how I had missed out on because of my drinking and drug using. We are in our 50s now, too late to start a family. How I wished I could go back and do everything over. One night, a few years later, I was jolted awake at 3 a.m. "Check your 23andMe account," an inner voice seemed to say. Maybe because I was half asleep, those words did not strike me as strange. I got up, logged into 23andMe on my phone, and saw there was nothing there. "Huh," I thought, then went back to bed. I must not have logged off the 23andMe account when I put down my phone. The website started sending me updates. I don't do much with phones, social media, all that stuff. I ignored the 23andMe updates. A few days later came the telltale text, "Hi." Now in the bathroom, I realized that all those pings were attempts by 23andMe to let me know there were messages from this person, Michael. I clicked through to them. There were lots of messages. "I'm not asking you for anything," said one. "I just want to know who you are and tell you a little bit more about me." Another asked, "Did you ever live in Laurel, Mississippi in the 1980s? My pulse raced. How could anyone know that? I worked for a year at the Laurel branch of my brother-in-law's pizza franchise. "Yes, I did live in Laurel in the 1980s, I typed with trembling fingers. There was an immediate response. "I have brown hair and blue eyes, and my son is left-handed. Do you have any of those traits?" My heart was really going. "All three," I replied. "How old are you? Can you send a picture?" "I'm 35, came the reply. The picture that followed could have been a younger image of myself. It was Michael, with his wife and two boys, aged 3 and 1. I had a son. There he was, right on the other side of that screen. I walked back to the living room in a daze. I turned off the TV. "I need to tell you something," I said to Lori. "I have a son." "Excuse me? What?" she said. "We have two grandchildren." She stared at me in shock. "How old is your son?" 35, I said. I saw her relax. Michael was a decade older than my marriage to Lori. I told her everything that I'd learned so far. We sat there, not knowing what to say. "This could be the biggest blessing of our lives," Lori finally said. I called Michael that evening and we talked for almost 3 hours. We had so much in common. Michael told me his story. His mom was one of my one-night stands. She didn't remember me and never tried to find me. She hadn't wanted a child, and Michael's upbringing had been difficult. His grandparents helped raise him. He went on to join the military, where he was awarded medals in Iraq as a technician defusing roadside bombs. For years, he had assumed his stepfather was his biological dad. Only when his mom divorced did he learn the truth. "Then who is my dad?" he asked. "No one knows," came the reply. After years of fruitless searching, Michael submitted his DNA to 23andMe. That night, when I logged into the website at 3 a.m., 23andMe sent Michael an alert that my account was active. His simple hi arrived just a few days later. How else can I explain all of this except to call it miracles upon miracles? Michael, his wife, Janie, and their boys, Bo and Brady, are now an inseparable part of our lives. Together, we form a family that none of us knew we would have. Michael, Janae, and the boys drove up from their home in Louisiana and spent last Thanksgiving at our place. We had already FaceTimed plenty by that point. Lori and I went into a frenzy getting ready. We bought a high chair, baby shampoo, sippy cups, toys, kid-friendly snacks, even a wading pool for the deck. It was warm that November. We planned a roast beef dinner and got the table set. I watched out the front window for Michael's silver pickup truck, the same color as my truck. At last, it pulled into the driveway. Lori went to help unbuckle Brady and Bo. Michael stepped out. He was tall like me, 6'2". I'm 6 feet. He extended his hand, not seeming sure how to greet me. "We hug around here," I cried, opening my arms wide. Michael and I held each other tight. There were hugs all around, tears, an overflowing of joy. We stayed a week. The time flew. We loved every chaotic moment. We compared baby pictures, told family stories, noticed mannerisms we share. We are both fidgety with our hands. We both go all in on our hobbies, such as woodworking. Even our voices are similar. "He sounds exactly like you," Lori said. There were more tears and when they left. "Bye, Lolly and Pop," the boys said, their nicknames for us. Janae hugged us both. Michael and I held each other again, not wanting to let go. Already, Lori and I had plans to visit them in Louisiana. They drove away, and we walked back into the house to discover a card waiting for us. "To Mom and Dad," the card said. We burst into tears all over again. Lori had been right. Michael and his family are the biggest blessing in our lives, a blessing straight from heaven. I truly believe that if I hadn't become a man of faith, I wouldn't have listened to that inner voice at 3 a.m. I certainly wouldn't have wanted to meet a son I never knew I had. Like I said, I did not consider myself father material. And those ancient aliens, I know now it was just me searching for something to believe in, something I found or that found me that first day in church. God saw more in me. He brought about a great work of mercy and love in my life, in Michael's life, and in the lives of both our families. A miracle that just keeps getting better and better. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.